died, Father. Is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something was missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't mess.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact life. And that is why you are here.
I'm Henrik. This is the one and only Red Ice Radio. Tolerate no cheap copies. Thank you for joining us today, wherever you might be and whatever you might be doing. Perhaps in transit, out taking a walk, lying in bed, working, or sitting in front of your computer, aspiring to learn more about our world. Well, whatever you're doing, we welcome each and every one of you, and we are grateful that you want to spend some of your time with us. Ralph Ellis is our guest today. He has been researching biblical and Egyptian history for more than 30 years. Being independent from theological and educational establishments allows Ralph to tread where others do not dare. And it's through this independence that Ralph has made many new biblical and historical discoveries. He returns to discuss his latest book, Jesus, King of Edessa. Ralph will talk about the Edessa family, a royal family most have never heard about. Ralph has discovered that one of the princes of Edessa had the same name as Jesus. We discuss Josephus Flavius as a historian who worked for the Romans, writing their propaganda, deleting the Edessa family. Ralph will explain how manufactured biblical gospel is still a version of the truth, written using the Pesher technique. Much more to come. Hi, Ralph. Welcome back. It's good to talk to you again. Thank you for coming on once again. It's always a lot of fun having you on, so we appreciate you coming back.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Henrik. It's a pleasure always to be on Red Ice. We get so much feedback through the Red Ice radio podcast. It's really good.
Excellent. That's really encouraging. So the journey continues, obviously, in the search for whom Jesus really was. And the latest book in the series is the proposition that he was the king of Edessa. It's another big volume with some very interesting suggestions and ideas, and I'm looking forward to diving into it. So as far as I understand, this is really a sequel to Cleopatra the Christ and King Jesus, Ralph. So where does King of Edessa pick up from these previous books?
Yes, it's become a bit of a trilogy, this one, and it's a very good trilogy, actually. And every time I thought I'd finished it, and then some more information comes along, so off we go again. We started with Cleopatra to Christ, where I sort of demonstrated that the biblical family probably were related to Queen Theomusa Aurania, who was an Egyptian who was married to a Parthian king and then was exiled from Parthia. So that was an interesting story. And then I built upon that, of course, with King Jesus, which firstly, in the first half of that book, tried to demonstrate that Saul, St. Paul, was Josephus, because I proposed this like 14 years ago or more.
Yeah.
And lots of people came back and said, no, it's impossible for this reason, that reason. So I decided once and for all to go and prove that that was possible, because it was crucial to understanding the chronology of the New Testament. And so the first half of that book, 300 pages odd, was proving that Saul and Josephus were the same person. Josephus being the first century historian, of course, who wrote all of the history of Judea. So that was the first half of that book. And then the second half of that book was picking up on this Queen Theomusa or Rania story and the biblical story, and demonstrating that Jesus was related to this royal family. In fact, they are the same family, but Josephus has two names for them, like he does with many of his stories. He has two versions of the same story. So one of the stories talks about Queen Theomusa Urania and her family coming from Persia, of course. And the other story is about a pseudo semi-Persian royal family called the Adiabenes. And so we have the royal family there are called King Monobazus, his son, who was Prince Isis. You can probably see some links coming on here. And their mother, who was Queen Helena. And demonstrated that this family were actually the biblical family. So therefore, Prince Isis became Prince Jesus, King Jesus. And this was the biblical family. This is what the story was all about. And I thought, hey, that's really good. I've clinched it now. I know who these people are. And it was a great book, and I think I proved it to great satisfaction that this is who these people were. But of course, it dawned on me as I finished this book that I didn't really prove anything, because this family, who are mentioned in the books of Josephus Flavius, are only mentioned in the books of Josephus Flavius. So they are sort of literary phantoms. They only exist in the books of Josephus, and therefore there's no archaeology to say who these people are. So it's very easy for people to say, well, it's just an invention by Josephus. It doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bit of a problem. So I'm back to square one. I've proved who these people were. So, you know, the biblical family, King Jesus was King Isis of Adiabene, but there is no evidence for them. There is no archaeology. And so that set me thinking again. And I forget what I came across as being. I was on the web and I was looking at something, and then I suddenly thought, that's right. I was looking at Professor Robert Eisenman and one of his, not his books, it was something on the net he had written. He had written this short paper. And it mentioned the royal family of Edessa. And I'd never heard of Edessa. In all of my trawling through the biblical texts and Josephus and all of that region, the history of that region, and I'd never heard of Edessa. And I suddenly thought, what? Who's this royal family that I've not heard about? Where did they come into this? And it's strange, isn't it? Have you ever heard of Edessa before and this particular royal family?
I have not, no.
King Agbarus, as he's known in historical texts. It's funny, isn't it? Because they were very famous in that era. In fact, and we'll start to link these two families together, if I'm correct, and sorry, if not just I'm correct, but if the Syriac historians, the ancient Syriac historians are correct, this is the family who caused and promoted the Jewish revolt. This was the royal family that started the Jewish revolt in AD 68. They prosecuted the revolt, and they were captured after Jerusalem fell, after the siege of Jerusalem. So they were central to this story, and yet they're not in the historical record. Well, sorry, I'll say that again. They're not in the normal record that you read of Judea.
Well,
so if you read the books of Josephus, and it's great now that we have online versions, so you can put in a search. Makes life much easier sometimes.
Helps quite a bit, exactly, yeah. And if those books are not indexed, it's a nightmare, you know?
Absolutely, a nightmare. And also, I was very lucky that this particular king had an internet name, which is brilliant. I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with internet names, but internet names are a name that is unique. So if you put in a search for it, you get that name. obviously, if you put in a search for Smith or Jones, you know, you'll just get littered with thousands and thousands of hits. Mm. But if you put in a search for Abgarus, which is fairly unusual, you know you're going to find that particular king. And within the books of Josephus, of course, there is no mention of Edessa, no mention of King Abgarus, no mention of his wife, who was called Shalmath, and no mention of his son, his very famous son, who was called Manu, King Manu. And they're just not in the books of Josephus. And you think, hold on a minute. This is the guy who wrote a complete history of Judeo-Syria of the first century. This particular royal family, as it became more and more apparent as time went on, were intimately linked with political events in Judea. So how are they not in the books of Josephus? Something's wrong here. And it took a bit of searching, of course, but it became apparent that Josephus was indulging in a cover-up. He does mention this family. He has to mention this family because they're very famous and they're very influential. But he doesn't name them by their normal names. What he's done is he's called them the royal family of Adiabeni. So this is the same family that I had linked previously with the biblical family, the Adiabeni royalty. They are the Edessans. So we have this strange conundrum, of course, that if you read the books of Josephus, you have this famous royal family from Adiabeni, and yet there's no evidence for these people, as I said before. If you go, they say that Adiabeni is over at Arbela, which is near Mosul, in sort of northwestern Iraq. Mm-hmm. Not sort of a place you really want to go to at this time, you know. They tend to be fighting a lot over there.
Sure.
So if you go to Mosul, which is where they say that the royal family of Adiabeni came from, there is no evidence for them. And I managed to get in touch with a historian from Arbela, which was the capital of Adiabeni. And he said, yeah, of course, there's plenty of evidence that Arbela was Adiabeni. And I said, great, okay. What is the evidence? Can you show me some, you know, photos, inscriptions, whatever? He said, well, read the books of Josephus. Yeah, okay. Well, that's not archaeological evidence, of course. All we have, again, is the word of Josephus. And so this Adiabeni royal family are completely figments, as it were, of Josephus' imagination. They're not just there in the historical record. However, what he's done is he's renamed the Edessans because he didn't want to mention the Edessan royal family. He's renamed them as the Adiabeni royal
family.
Why? Well, we'll go into these names later and why he's chosen these names. Josephus was having a joke with us. You know, he was, I call him the quicksilver-quilled historian, because everything to him was a bit of a joke. He was the master of everything. After Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70, he was the master of everything because he was working for the Romans. He could do what he liked. He could destroy any text he liked. He could create any text he liked. He could create any history he liked. And he did so. And he did it from a Roman perspective. He was working for the Romans, remember. And the major event of that era was the Jewish revolt. So here we have the emperor, and the emperor is now, this is after the revolt, and the emperor now is Emperor Vespasian. And Rome is pretty pissed off with Judea, basically, because it's nothing but a bag of trouble. There are revolts going on all the time, and the Jewish revolt was a major revolt within the Roman Empire. And of course, the empire doesn't like revolts because they have a habit of spreading. And so Rome wants the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. And so they set about systematically preventing any further trouble in the eastern borders. Mm-hmm. Now, the trouble had been caused by the Edessan royal family, as I said before. But Josephus didn't want to admit that, because he now wants to distance this revolt from the perpetrators of the revolt. He's trying to prevent any further unrest in the Eastern Empire. So he never mentions the Edessans, even though they caused and prosecuted this revolt. He never mentions them. He calls them the Adiabenians instead. So in the books of Josephus, the people who started the Jewish revolt are King Jesus of Adiabeni, and the person who was captured after the Jewish revolt was King Jesus of Adiabeni. Of course, and then he has this wonderful little story where he relates that after the siege of Jerusalem, so Jerusalem is destroyed, the leaders of the revolt were captured. He goes off to Herodium, which is just south of Jerusalem. He comes back from Herodium, and he sees three of the leaders of the revolt being crucified in the Kidron Valley. But they are his previous compatriots, because you've got to remember that Josephus changed sides. He was on the rebel side, and then he changed side to the Romans. So these were previously his compatriots. So he made a petition to the governor of Jerusalem to take them down from the cross. And he did. He took them down from the cross. Two of them died, but one survived. Hmm. And of course, the leader of the revolt was called Jesus, or as we would know him, Jesus, of course. And the person who took him down from the cross was called Josephus. Josephus of Arimathea, of course. So you can see where the story starts connecting up. And this is why Josephus never mentions the Adiabeni royal family. Sorry, the Edessan royal family.
Edessa, yeah.
Because they were the leaders of the revolt. So what he's done is he's deleted Edessa from history. And he's deleted that royal family from history. So he calls them the Adiabenans, and he relocates them out in Iraq somewhere, when in fact they came from Edessa. And Edessa is, if you close your eyes and think about the Near East, if you go north of Aleppo and head up into sort of Turkey, you will come to a place called Sanlurfa. And Sanlurfa is Edessa. So it's just north of Syria. It used to be in the borders of ancient Syria. They call it Syria. But nowadays it's in Turkey nowadays. This is what happened to this family. They were deleted from history intentionally. And so then we have to go and rediscover this royal family and see how they connect with the biblical story.
So if I understand it correctly, Josephus does this because he wants to be true to history in one regard, but obviously he doesn't want to give credit to those who are really responsible for it. So he names them after a completely different region for some reason. What is the benefit with that?
Well, because Josephus is working for the Romans, and he doesn't want the rebels to have any fame for being rebels. I don't know how we could put that into a modern context, but if you can imagine a country that had a rebellion that attacked its neighbor or something, in order to quell that rebellion so it doesn't happen again in the future, you just delete that history, as it were, from history.
Well, that's very common if we look at
very, very. Yeah. And so what he's done is he said, oh, it's nothing to do with these people over here. In fact, we're not going to mention these people over here at all. They just, they don't exist. It was a revolt that was caused by these people over here. They're something completely different. And of course, they're also conveniently outside the Roman Empire. You know, Arbela was outside the Roman Empire. It was nothing to do with Rome. So this was not a revolt that was caused by anyone that was in the Roman Empire. No. It was these people over here. So his amendment to history is pure Roman propaganda. And this was a propaganda 1-2 punch. So this is the historical record we're talking about. This is Josephus writing what he calls history. Okay, it's propaganda, but it's history. But the number two punch was he wrote exactly the same story with the same characters as a spiritual fantasy story, which was all peace and love and roses and turning the other cheek. And we call that story Christianity. So what I'm saying is that Josephus actually wrote not only Antiquities and Jewish War, he also wrote the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel Acts of the Apostles. Those were also out of his studio. And so he wrote, because the story is the same, so the story of the Gospels is the story of the Edessan royal family. This is their history. And so, as we know, you know, Jesus was a bit of a rebel. And when he went for his crucifixion, as it says in the Gospels, that he was actually thrown into prison alongside the other people in the rebellion who had committed murder in the rebellion. As it says in Matthew, I think it says in... this was the same story. This was King Jesus, but obviously in the Gospels they call him King Jesus. This is the guy who was crucified in the Kidron Valley, exactly the same as Josephus relates in his historical works. So this is a propaganda one too. The historical work, which of course Josephus says in the preface of his books, the first place he sent it to was the people of Adiabeni beyond the Euphrates, which are the Edessans. And of course, if you go beyond the Euphrates, the first town you come to is Edessa, of course. And so the first people that he sent his Jewish War to, his book called Jewish War, was the Edessans. And basically the Jewish War said, Rome is invincible, so don't mess with Rome. And then the next book he sent to Edessa, because they always said that the first city in the East to take up Christianity was Edessa, not Jerusalem. The first mm-hmm. city was Edessa. And this second book said, oh, this revolt was not a real revolt, of course. This was just peace and love, and they were being persecuted and all the rest of it. And so you can see how you can use the Gospels to quell a rebellion, to quell a rebellious people. The first book said, don't mess with Rome. And the second book said, turn the other cheek, no matter, you know, how you're persecuted.
Right, right.
And it didn't fully work, of course, because, you know, after the Jewish revolt, they then had the Bar Kokhba uprising in AD 35, mm-hmm. AD 135, of course.
Let me ask you this quickly. If Josephus' allegiance ultimately, though, is with the Romans here, and if this is propaganda, as you say, why should we believe any of it if we're concerned with finding the true history of the Jews and what was going on in that at that time in that region?
Well, Josephus was a historian, and he was quite proud of being a historian. So he wanted to record true history. He wasn't quite allowed to record true history, but to the best of his ability, he was going to do so. So what he's done is he hasn't fabricated a complete fairy story from nothing. He's taken the true history and bent it to match his requirements. And his requirements obviously came from Emperor Vespasian. So all he's done is he's changed the names and hinted that they came from somewhere else, but he doesn't actually say that they came from Arbela. This is why nobody can find Adiabeni in the historical record. He doesn't say this is where this city was located. He just says it's beyond the Euphrates. It's beyond the Euphrates. But of course, Edessa is beyond the Euphrates. So he's not lying. He's just sort of bending the truth a bit. And this is what he does all along. So what we then have to do is try and find the reason behind his new pseudonyms. Why does he call it Adiabeni? Why does he call the king Monobazus? And why does he call the other king Isus? Well, Isus is probably fairly easy to decipher. It's Jesus, of course. And in this case, the history seems to indicate that the name did not come from the Aramaic Yeshua. It actually came from the Persian, which is Izates. So it looks like we've got the derivation completely wrong of this name. It came from the Persian side. The original was Izates, sometimes called Izad, and sometimes called Isus. And it was from that that we derived Jesus, or Isus, in the Greek. So that name is fairly easy to decipher, one might say.
Yeah, what a confusing turn of events with all these name changes and the propaganda that's going on, trying to figure and weave this Gordian knot out. It's just incredible.
It is. It's a real Gordian knot. But the delightful thing about it is that it all works. It's not just that we have changed a name. It's that all of the names fit. All of the names dovetail with the original history. So it's not one name being translated, it's the entire history matches and dovetails with the original history perfectly. That's why I'm confident that this is a true identification. Because all of the events, not just the names, all of the events, everything that happened, fits in with the historical record, from what we know of the historical record. Once you know what Josephus was talking about, and how he deliberately is not mentioning this particular royal family. And of course, what we end up with, of course, is a king who was the leader of the revolt, who matches the biblical Jesus in pretty much all respects. So this was a guy who was called Jesus. But in the historical record, in the records of Edessa, of course, he has another name, which is Manu. And we know that Manu and Isus were the same person. And again, this is why nobody's picked up on this history before, because there is no real records of them in the sort of Western world. But when I went out to Syria and started reading the Syriac historians have their own history of these events, and in fact their own history of biblical events as well. And it just so happens that the Syriac historians continually say that Queen Helena, and she was the queen of Adiabeni, married King Agbaras, and he was the king of Edessa, of course. This is how we know that these two, well, one of the many reasons that we know that these two royal families are linked. So the queen of Adiabeni was also the queen of Edessa. And that gives the lie away that Josephus was perpetrating, because she was the queen of Edessa, and therefore Adiabeni is Edessa. Therefore all of the Adiabeni royal family are, in fact, the Edessan royal family. And so the son in the two records is either called Isus or he's called Manu. And this, almost as soon as I saw that, this struck me as being an obvious cover-up. In fact, a delightful cover-up, I would say, because these are the names of Jesus, of course. Listeners might not recognize it straight away, but for some reason I just recognized it as soon as I saw it. If we go back into the Gospels, the primary prophecy that ensured that Jesus was, you know, the Messiah, the Christ, and you've got to remember that the Messiah and Christ just mean king. They're not spiritual names, really. So Christ simply means the anointed one, the king. So Jesus only became king because of this prophecy. And this prophecy said, that a virgin would give birth to a son and he would be called Emmanuel. And that's a very strange prophecy, because it's the most crucial prophecy within the Old within the New Testament. It comes from the Old Testament, of course, but it was used as a prophecy for the New Testament. But Jesus was never called Emmanuel. So the primary prophecy that made Jesus a king was never used, because he was never called Emmanuel. It's a bit strange, really, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But it's perfect. It's perfect. Because Josephus has made this up. Because I say, of course, that Josephus wrote, you know, the Gospel of Luke and Acts of the Apostles as well. So he was in on the gospel manufacturing market as well. What they've used is a Pesha. A Pesha technique from the Talmud. Pesha is using Old Testament verses to match them with current events and therefore to predict the future. But as it says in the preface to the Talmud, it can also be used to cover up particular characters and particular events. So if you can think of a similar event from the Old Testament that used a different name because there were different characters in that particular event, but the event was similar, then you can use the old characters and pretend that they are the new characters. So you can cover up who was actually doing something by using an Old Testament equivalent.
Hmm.
And this is what they used Pesha for, because the rabbis feared persecution, because they were quite often, they mentioned Jesus quite a lot within the Talmud. And of course, what they were saying was not terribly complimentary in the Talmud about Jesus. And of course, they could be persecuted for this. They could be strung up. I mean, they say that Jesus was the criminal of Israel, responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem. And he should be boiled in semen and boiled in shit.
Nice.
Very nice, yeah. In a way, you can see why they're upset, because in this new scenario, this new chronology, Jesus was actually responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the rabbi's temple. So they were not best pleased with this guy, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't say that, because, of course, they would be persecuted themselves. Anything after, you know, A.D. 325 with the Council of Nicaea, and they would be liable to terrible persecution themselves. So they didn't actually always write his name. In fact, they never used his name, I think. They normally called him by a pseudonym, and one of the common pseudonyms they used was Balaam, because the things that Balaam did in the Old Testament matched what they thought Jesus was doing in current events in the New Testament. So they called him Balaam instead. So that's what you use Pesha for. You use Pesha for covering up who's doing what. And if we come back to this prophecy, they've done exactly the same with this prophecy about Jesus. So the prophecy says that a virgin will give birth to a son, and his name will be called Emmanuel. And of course, he is called Emmanuel, because Emmanuel is derived from Immanuel. And in the historical record, the prince of Edessa was called Manu. So he was called Emmanuel. It works perfectly. It's just
Manu, a god, and El, God, Im, does that mean anything per se, or is it just something they put in there to...
It means God is with us, is the translation, but I'm not entirely... You see, I'm not entirely sure that this is correct, because like the name for Jesus, which they say comes from Yeshua, it might not be an Aramaic word. You see, these people were Egyptians. They had gone to Persia, Parthia, as Egyptians. Greco-Egyptians, I suppose. They were half Greek and half Egyptian. They had been in Parthia, in Persia. They had been kicked out of Persia. And so the names that they would be using were probably Parthian, Persian names, or Egypto-Parthian names, because we have names like Isis, which is actually more Persian than anything else. We have names like Shalmath, which again is not really Aramaic. We have Agbaras, which might be Aramaic. And then we have Manu. Now, is Manu an Aramaic name, or is that some sort of Parthian name? I don't know, because the direct equivalent you have of Manu, of course, is he's not a god, he's a godlet of Hinduism. Manu the fish. He's one of the great characters within the Hindu religion, was called Manu. And within this particular history, I keep finding links between Hinduism and this sort of Eastern Nazarene Christianity, as it were.
Really? What does that mean, do you think? What is that pointing to?
I don't quite know. I don't know enough about Hinduism to actually make a decision on this. But I get the impression that Hinduism is not as old as they like to make out. I think, on balance, Hinduism came from these Egypto-Greek religions rather than the other way around. Everyone says, you know, Hinduism and the Indian religions are really ancient. They go back thousands of years and so on. But they don't, in my estimation, appear to do so. It's just the texts. They always keep adding zeros onto the number of years, I think, to make them older and older and older. But the texts look as though they've come from this particular Nazarene-type religion. For instance, in the previous book, when I was investigating the Omphalos stones, these sort of conical stones which are central to Judaism, central to Greek religion, central to Nazarene religion in Edessa, because they had these Omphalos stones as well. And they have them in India, of course. And in India, they say they're really ancient. You know, this is really ancient part of Hindu-type religion. And then you see them basting, because they have to pour oils, is like it says in the Old Testament, when I think it was Jacob made a pillar for his head to lie his head on, which was a stone. The pillar was actually a stone. It was a mastaba, which he poured oils on. And they do exactly the same in India, of course. They pour oils onto these Omphalos stones. But they pour oil out of a Minoan rhyton. I'm not sure if listeners are familiar with the rhyton, but if you can imagine a bull's horn turned upside down, so the pointy end is pointing downwards, you fill it with oil, you make a little hole in the bottom, and that is your vessel for pouring oils onto the Omphalos stone.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And this is what the Indians are using to base their Omphalos stones as well. It's a Minoan rhyton. It's exactly the same. And you think, hold on a minute, no, this is supposed to be an ancient Indian religion, and yet they're using something which is very peculiar to Crete and to Greek religion.
Yeah.
And of course, to me it's not surprising, because Alexander the Great took his army right the way through Iraq, Iran, over into India. And so he was in India as almost, you know, the Shah of India. It's not surprising that Greek traditions and Greek religion would have been taken to India at that particular time. This is about 325 BC.
Well, I mean, as we know, Ralph, when wars happen and armies move in into new territory and in some cases even exterminate the people that are there. We have new folks coming in and taking over the region, new customs, new habits, new languages arise, everything like that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, they took their language. I mean, their language didn't last very long in India, but they took their language all across the East. You know, all of Iraq, all of Iran, all spoke Greek in, you know, between the 3rd century and the 1st century BC. Greek was the lingua franca, as we call it, the language of the East. All of Judea, all of Syria would have all spoken Greek.
Not Aramaic.
Well, Aramaic was there as well, of course. The native language of the Edessans, the early Edessans, was actually more Aramaic than it was Greek. But later on, if you look at 2nd century Edessan coins, they've turned from Aramaic into Greek.
Okay.
So they went the other way. But if you look at all of the Parthian coins, all of the Parthian coins, the Parthia being Persia, what we would call Iraq and most of Iran, all the coins there were in Greek. So Greek was the main language of that region. That's how far it spread towards the east.
Yeah.
So to me, it's not surprising that we find elements of these religions turning up on the western shores of India with the Omphalos stones, with Manu, as I was saying, who becomes one of the... He's not a deity, he's a demigod, I suppose, within Hinduism. And then, of course, in Edessa, the chief priest who looked after the stone, because Edessa also had these Omphalos stones, which we'll come to later because that's an interesting story. Don't let me forget about that one.
Okay, yeah.
they had these Omphalos stones as well. And the priest who looked after the Omphalos stone in Edessa was called the Buddha. And, you know, to be honest, I don't have enough knowledge about Eastern religions, Indian religions, to say that the Buddha came from an Edessan tradition. But from what I just looked up very quickly, the Buddha is not that ancient in terms of the evidence we have, in terms of the statues and the writings that mention the Buddha. So I don't know. It's something that I'm going to have to leave to someone else, because I don't know enough about Indian religions to pinpoint any of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting, nevertheless. But that's a bit of a sideshow in the book.
Sure, sure.
It's just something I came across in my travels, as it were.
All right. Well, maybe something to investigate and look into further ahead, huh?
Oh, I'm sure we'll get around to it, yes.
By the way, while we're talking about, coins and such as well, do you want to talk a little bit about the, what led to the cover, front cover, basically, and the coins found and all that?
Yes. Everything was interesting in this particular investigation. And that was an interesting one as well, because, again, this was all a voyage of discovery. And you can imagine... I knew nothing, like your listeners know nothing, about this royal family. It was all a complete mystery to me, even though I'd immersed myself in Judeo-Syrian history for 15 years. I'd never heard of this particular royal family, so I knew nothing about them. And so now I'd been through some of this, I knew their names and so on, and I was getting more and more familiar with them. Dear old King Akbarus, who's actually in the New Testament, of course. In the New Testament, they call him Abgarus. So they change it round a little bit. His name is supposed to be Akbarus, and in the New Testament, they call him Abgarus, the other way around. Most confusing. So anyway, that's how famous he is. He's in the New Testament. He's in Acts of the Apostles, where they say that he was involved in sending money, famine relief, down to Judea, of course. And this is another connection with the real history that we know, because the people who took the famine relief money from Edessa down to Jerusalem were Saul, St. Paul, and Barnabas.
Hmm.
And yet this money was coming from Queen Helena, who was the wife of King Akbarus. So even in the New Testament, these particular characters were so famous, they were being mentioned in the New Testament. So I was getting used to all of these people. And then it was about time that I started looking at the numismatic records, the coin records, because that's always a good way of, finding out what's happening in a particular location, because it's a hard and fast record. These are coins that people manufactured. This is actual contemporary evidence of what was going on at that time. Dates, kings, people, religions often, because, you know, on the reverse of the coin, you'll often get a picture of the god and what symbols that they believed in and so on.
Yeah.
So I started looking for Edessan coins. And, of course, every single Edessan coin has a bust of a king on the coin. And the king is always wearing a crown of thorns. And this happens all the way through Edessan history, from the 1st century all the way through to the 3rd century, when Edessa finally was absorbed into the Roman Empire. So they all wear a crown of thorns. And, you know, this stood out like a sore thumb to me. It's so obvious that it's exactly the same description as we have for Jesus in the crucifixion scene, because Jesus was wearing a crown of thorns. More than that, I started searching the various coins, because not all coins are, you know, good copies. Some are better than others. Some of the profiles are not exactly the same as other profiles. And then I found a series of these coins where the crown is not simply a crown of thorns, it's a plaited crown of thorns. And of course, the exact description from the New Testament is that the crown that Jesus was given was a plaited crown of thorns.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same. And it's a shame we can't do this with pictures, but there we go. This is one of the limitations of radio.
Yeah, there are some great pictures of this in the book, by the way, and the, coins are really they give away quite a bit there, definitely.
Yeah, they're very good, but for listeners who can't see them, this is not the crown of thorns that you've been led to believe. You know, everyone, because they wanted to make Jesus into some sort of rustic artisan, you know, a carpenter, a poor carpenter.
Martyr.
Pure of mind and spirit, you know, and all that sort of business. So they gave him a crown of brambles, you know, tied around his head. That is not what it is at all. As you've seen on the front of the book, it is actually a proper royal crown. And it's sort of, it's domed with a sort of crisscross plaiting around the side of it. And thorns or projections coming out all over the crown of it. So it's a proper royal crown. It's not a few brambles tied with string. And of course, this is what this sort of person would have. He was a king. He was a king of Edessa. It was a very wealthy, very powerful province within northern Syria. And listeners shouldn't sort of immediately think that everything in Syria is poor and downtrodden, you know, as we see it today. That is not Syria as it should be. It's only like that because they've had Islam there for 1,000 years, and Islam has completely destroyed the place. In the Roman era, Syria, Jordan, Judea were the richest parts of the Roman Empire. I mean, if you want to see the biggest towns, cities, and temples of the Roman Empire, you've got to go to Syria and Jordan. That's where they are. Lebanon as well. Mm-hmm. Baalbek, of course.
Yeah.
Baalbek is the biggest temple ever within the Roman Empire.
You think the Romans built that, though?
They did the top bit. They did the bottom
that
bit.
They did.
It's like Jerusalem. I mean, if you go to Jerusalem, the Temple Mount is not Judean. It's not Roman. That's megalithic.
Yeah, that's something else completely
different. Yes, something
different.
Else entirely. Yeah. Same at Baalbek. The top bit's Roman. And I have to say, the Roman bits are impressive enough. I mean, they were using, if you can imagine, a column that is made of drums, and the drums are 2 meters wide. So this is a column that's over 2 meters wide. It was about 2.4, I think, meters wide. It's a huge column. So even the Roman bits are pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But of course, underneath, the foundations are pure megalithic, and they're, in some respects, even more impressive, because the stones there at Baalbek, they were using stones that weighed about 1,200 tons, something of that nature.
Yeah.
I mean, these were just vast. They, I think if I remember correctly, it was 24 meters long was one brick. Jeez.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah, I've got, actually on my Facebook page, I've got a picture of that, which is quite interesting if anyone wants to look at it.
Yeah, you're standing on top of it. I've seen that many times. Great photo.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of shows a little bit as well, Ralph, overall, what we're talking about here when it comes to different, you know, people, different races being in different places at different times. And also at the same time, there seems to be a kind of a general losing, if you will, of that ancient knowledge. The further away we go in history, the more disconnected we get from you know, the true story of everything, pretty much.
And the poorer we get as well. You know, whoever built the foundations of Baalbek and Jerusalem were immensely powerful, and therefore one assumes immensely rich. Whoever built, well, we know who built, you know, the Jerusalem temple and the Roman temple on the top of Baalbek must have been immensely powerful, and one assumes rich, because these are the biggest temples in the Roman Empire. So not quite as rich as the megalithic, but still a very thriving society.
Yeah.
And then you go there now, and when I went to Baalbek, oh gosh, what a place. They were so poor, there were only two kebab shops in the whole of the city, because nobody could afford to go out and eat, so there were no restaurants. And so all they had in a city, which was pretty big, I don't know, you know, let's call it 70,000 people or so, they only had two kebab shops. That is how poor the place has become. So we're sliding downwards. We're not going upwards, you know. We're going back into the Dark Ages if we're not careful. It's a real shame, real shame.
Now, Ralph, in a, you know, 5-10 minutes or so, we're going to take a little break here. I wanted to ask you a little bit more, though, about the dress as well, the dressing of you know, the image that you have on the front cover, in terms of there's some other depictions. There is one on some Armenian, you know, bills as well. And you talk a little bit about that this is not, you know, the correct dressing, basically, with the colors and the caps and everything else. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yes. In Armenia, King Akbaras is still famed as being a king of Armenia. And so he's one of their local heroes. So they considered him to be an Armenian king, even though he wasn't. He was actually independent. He was an Edessan king. But Armenia has this habit of taking other kings and claiming them to be theirs. Quite often they took Parthian kings as well and claimed them to be Armenian as well. And one of the kings they took was King Akbaras of Edessa, and he's still a local hero. And so they have him on one of their one of their notes. But they've dressed him in sort of, I don't know, 19th century sort of royal outfit, which is completely ludicrous. I mean, they've made no attempt to make this true to life of the first century. And I suppose perhaps they didn't know exactly what he looked like. We have profiles, of course. No, actually, that's wrong. We have stand-up copies of him. On some of their coins, they don't just have the profile. Some of them have the later King Akbars presenting Nike to the Emperor of Rome. And so it's only a very small character. You can imagine the character himself is only like 1.5 centimeters high, just over 1/2 inch. So it's not a very big character. But it clearly shows him in some sort of Roman army dress with, you know, the standard patuges, I think they call them, the kilt, the Roman kilt, the Roman short gladius, the short sword, and his domed crown of thorns on his head. So it's quite obvious, actually, from those coins what he should really look like, but that's not how they depict him. But as it happens, I was also investigating Palmyra as part of the previous book. And in Palmyra, they have an even better statue of him. They have a statue, it's about a meter high, I suppose, of the same character. And it is from this statue that I have taken the image for Jesus. And thinking about it later, this probably is actually a statue of Jesus, a statue of King Manu of Edessa, who is Jesus. So this was a contemporary statue, because they think it was carved in about AD 50, which would be just about the right time for this chronology.
Hmm. So that might be a pretty good guess, pretty much, of what we're looking
yeah,
at.
Yeah, I think it could be actually his an image of his statue, because he's portrayed as the messenger of the gods. And that was the role of the monarchs of Parthia in that era. They were always displayed as being the messenger of the gods between the sun and the moon. And that's exactly how this statue is portrayed. So we have the sun character as a humanoid character, and the moon character as a humanoid character. And between the two, we have the messenger of the gods, the Belshaman. And he's portrayed in the image of King Manu, who I say is Jesus. This is, you know, let's get his name correctly, this King Jesus Manu. Because remember, we have conflated, we have joined together the two kings, one from Adiabene, who was called Jesus, and the other one from Edessa, who was called Manu. So when we join those two royal families, his name becomes Jesus Manu. And of course, when we go to the New Testament, the name of Jesus is Jesus Emmanuel. Jesus Manu, Jesus Emmanuel. It's the same person, it's the same names. And we have his statue, which is interesting, because now we have a statue of Jesus, contemporary. I mean, it's not a later copy. This is from AD 50, when he was actually living. And it shows us what he looked like. So, yeah, we now have a complete image of what Jesus looked like. And he is not too dissimilar, actually, to what we would imagine. So if you can imagine a sort of romanticized image of Jesus with the long hair, the beard, and the moustache, that's pretty much what he looks like.
It's interesting. I wanted to ask you this as well before we take a break here, Ralph, quickly. But considering this and what you've your latest discovery, if we look forward in the chronology of the descendants of this royal family, does this take you down a different road than what you've suggested before, or does it still match up with that?
It still matches in a way, but it's something that needs fleshing out. I haven't had time to go through the descendants, but there were descendants, of course. King Manu the Sixth was not the last king of Edessa. What happened is he surrendered at Jerusalem when Jerusalem fell. He was taken into custody. He was never seen again. In my previous book, obviously, I speculate that he was exiled to England, but that's another story.
Could that still match up, do you think?
Oh, yes. Yeah, very much so, because they had a rebel who they had just captured on the eastern borders of the empire. What do you do with that rebel? You've only got two choices. You either kill him or you exile him. And for many reasons, the Romans couldn't kill him. A, he was too important. B, he was a bit like a demigod. C, he had done a deal with Vespasian, Emperor Vespasian, because Emperor Vespasian was not a royal. He had no connection with the Caesars of Rome. So by rights, he should not have been emperor. He needed something behind him, some oracle, some prophecy to allow him to become emperor. And what he did is he stole the star prophecy from Jesus. So the great oracle, which was mainly put out by Josephus, I think, the main oracle of Rome at that time was that the new emperor would be a star from the east. That was the star prophecy. And Vespasian used that star prophecy to become emperor. But, of course, who was born under the eastern star? It was Jesus. So what Vespasian did is he stole Jesus' prophecy and took it for his own. So in a way, he sort of owed Jesus one. You know, he'd just nicked his prophecy. He'd just nicked his birthright. And so as a quid pro quo, he allowed him to live. But of course, he couldn't allow him to live in Judea because, you know, this guy had just started a great revolt on the eastern borders of the empire. So he was exiled. And he was exiled, well, what do you do with a dangerous exile? You take him away from his power base. And as far as you can get away from Judea in the first century was England. And that's where he was exiled to. So he was exiled to Chester, Fortress Dewa in Chester. But yeah, that's an interesting story.
It is just a comparison you made to Elba and Napoleon and all that as well. Ralph, yeah. Let's take a short break here. We'll take a pause and continue in the second segment. There's more to get to, more to talk about, of course. We have hardly scratched the surface of what you go into in the book. Why don't we wrap up you giving out some of your details, obviously the website where people can go to pick up copies of the latest book and if they're interested in previous versions as well, Ralph.
Yes, sure. So the website is edfu, that's edfu-books.com. There's 10 books in the series now. So we have the Old Testament books. So we have things like Eden in Egypt, Tempest in Exodus, Solomon, King of Pharaoh of Egypt. And then this latest one was, of course, the King Jesus trilogy. And that starts with Cleopatra to Christ, and then King Jesus, and then finally this last one, which is only out in December last year, which is Jesus, King of Edessa. So they're all on the website. They're all mainly as ebooks. I've really gone to ebooks at present because as a low volume publisher, it makes things much easier to have ebooks than printed books for many reasons. So they're all available on iPad and Kindle and all that sort of business. And actually, I've got used to it, and I sort of prefer them now because you can do, you know, global searches within the book to find topics, and you can still make notes in the book and everything like that. So they're quite convenient, these tablet books.
Yeah, I agree. It's great to have some videos embedded in them as well. So.
Yep, we have videos as well, yes. That's a novel thing. We managed to get them to work in the end.
Right, cool. Well, edfu-books.com is the website. We'll have that linked up, and I'm going to ask you a little bit more about, some of the academics out there is calling you a conspiracy theorist. They're going after you for some of your ideas, so I'm going to ask you more about that in the second year. So stay with us, Ralph. We'll be right back after this.
I can't believe it. I'm a 21st century digital boy.
website is redicecreations.com. Tons of free stuff for you to explore there. No ads, no commercial interruptions. And when you're hungry for more, redicemembers.com is a place to go. Acquire a membership and enjoy the rest of the vast archives that we have there for you. And in our next hour, our members' hour, we will continue on the Omphalos stone found in the Temple of Delphi, reputed to have been a conical meteoric stone that arrived in a dramatic and fiery fashion from the heavens above. Ralph talks about where else we can find stories about stones with magical properties. Then we'll hear about royals with cone heads, and where else we see this in history. Was the conical Edessan crown also designed to cover and conceal an elongated royal conehead? Ralph entertains ideas of ancient astronauts, and later we return to the motives of Josephus Flavius, a possible double agent. Ralph explains how the writings of Flavius have taken humanity on a diversion from Gnosis. And before we carry on, next on Red Ice Radio we have Troy McLaughlin and Theodore A. Holden on their new book, Cosmos in Collision. After this, Ulla Damagod, Harry Hubbard, Graham Hancock, and Penny Pierce are some of our future guests. So much more to come, but right now we'll proceed with the second hour with Ralph Ellis. Don't miss it. We'll see you on the other side.